I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Today on First Lady and Friends, we had an incredible conversation, a really tough but important conversation about child sexual abuse and how we can prevent it, how we can help those who have experienced this kind of trauma. Our guests today were Chris and Betsy from the Sapria organization, and they are doing amazing work. I hope you enjoy the conversation as I did. Let's get proximate. Today on First Lady and Friends, we have some really incredible guests, brand new friends to me this very day, but we've been connected through some of the work we've been doing, and we're just really thrilled to have Chris Yaden here, the executive director of Sapria, and as well as Betsy Karanowski. Did I say that right?
Kanarowski.
Oh, I was getting so close. Kanarowski, chief program officer. And they are here. They are committed to really tackling the issue of a sexual assault and sexual abuse. And I just think it's really incredible. This month, April, is Child Abuse Prevention Month. Of course, we're preventing it all year long, but this month is that awareness month. The colors, hopefully you've seen the color blue around and you've seen the pinwheels around, and it's a really important time to focus on this, because I think it's an issue that has touched, I would say, every person in some way, shape, or form. Would you agree to that?
Yeah, definitely. When you look at statistics, both locally here in Utah and nationally, they're very consistent. Nationally, 1 in 5 children are sexually abused by age 18. Here in Utah, we have a few different statistics that we see. The Utah Department of Health puts it just over 13%, mm-hmm. which is about 1 in 7. Then we have information from the CDC. They interview our high school age kids every 2 years. And our high school age girls report having been sexually assaulted. 21.2% of them report having been sexually assaulted in the last 12 months here in the state of Utah. Gosh. So whether you're looking nationally or here at home, we've got a challenge, and it's impacting our families. It's impacting our businesses. It's impacting each of our individual lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And before we really dive into this, we want to get have all the time we can to really address these things and the way we're doing prevention, the way we're addressing therapy, and the things that happen after somebody has experienced this trauma. But let's go back and start. Betsy, let's talk about, where did you grow up in the state? Did you, where I see that you spent time here, your education, your PhD is here, but you've also spent time in your education elsewhere. Where did you grow up? Tell me a little bit about that and your family.
So I grew up in Idaho Falls. So, finally making my way to Utah, to the big city, has been a dream realized after growing up.
Fantastic.
And I did my undergrad at University of Wyoming, got mm-hmm. a bachelor's degree in social work, did my master's degree at University of Denver in social work, and then a PhD in special ed at the U.
Oh, that's amazing. And so growing up in Idaho Falls, did you have a big family? Did you have a small family? You tell me a little bit about your background.
I am an only child.
Oh, wow. See, I come from a family of 10. So that is so unique.
My parents moved from the Bay Area and thought, we are going to move to Idaho, which seemed like the most romantic place in the world to them in the early 70s. We're heading for Idaho.
So what was that decision like? They had work there, or they just said, we're just getting out?
They had work there. So, they moved to Idaho and I grew up there. It was a wonderful place to grow up. My parents were Peace Corps volunteers before mm-hmm. I was born. So I suppose I was destined to be a social worker. There was no way around it. It's what I grew up in.
I love it. So Chris, tell me a little bit about you.
So I grew up in Orem, right on the edge of one of Orem's cherry orchards. There aren't many of them left.
It's true.
My grandfather was a fruit farmer, so I mostly grew up barefoot in a cherry orchard. It was an amazing way to grow up. And though Orem looks quite a bit different today, anytime I go back, I still have the smells from the cherry blossoms, the view of that beautiful spring at this time of year, those beautiful spring blossoms, and lots of recollection of being out in the orchard playing while Grandpa was working. Mm-hmm. He probably took me out to help him, but I think I did more playing than working,
as
we do when we're younger. I grew up with a pretty big family, 6 kids, 3 boys and 3 girls. And, each of those children have stayed close here to home. Our furthest one away is down south in Kanab, but everybody's here in Utah, and married a girl from Utah and have 6 kids myself, plus an exchange student that we call our 7th child that lives in Germany.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's incredible. So let's talk a little bit about how you got started in this area. You were formerly Unique Foundation, and so let's talk about that transition, and let's talk a little bit about the work here with preventing child sex abuse.
Yeah, it really starts with our founders, Derek and Shalane Maxfield. They saw a need. Sexual abuse had touched people that they love, just like the rest of us. And they had one of those conversations, those pivotal conversations of somebody should do something about this. Yeah. And that turned to we should do something about it. It actually, they were already independently wealthy at that point in their lives from selling other businesses. But they felt like they needed to do something great with their lives. And so this called to them. As a way to champion the cause here at home, but also broader at a national and even global scale. So then they came the question as they researched it that this is a big problem, and it's going to require a lot of money. How are we going to fund this? Even though they had their personal wealth, they didn't have what it was going to take to really move the needle on this. So they started a for-profit company to fund it, and that was Unique Products. And we originally started as the Unique Foundation. We had a really close partnership. We're not a corporate foundation. We never were. We've always been a public charity, but they were a major funder of ours. Well, true to who they are and what they try to do, it isn't about their business. And there came a point in time where they're like, this needs to grow out and bigger than the Unique family. Mm-hmm. And in order to attract corporate partnerships, broad-based public support, we needed to rebrand. We also need to rebrand with the goal of taking some of our healing services to men. Currently, they're only for women. Mm-hmm. And the Unique brand's very feminine, so we need to rebrand for that. And we also needed a global brand. And Unique, the word, isn't conducive to a lot of languages the way a word like Sapria is. So those are the reasons why we rebranded. The way I would like people to think about Unique's role, they're our founding partner, always will be, and they continue to support us. We're like their child.
Okay.
We're 18, and they're like, you need to go be bigger and do more than what you could do in our house. And that's the unselfish side of Derek and Shalane Maxfield.
That's incredible. Betsy, let's talk a little bit about more about statistics. I know that we hear that 1 in 7 or 1 in 5 or 1 in 3 girls or, you know, whatever we hear those, but let's get kind of underneath those and let's talk about what it really looks like as far as statistics go.
So it's 1 in 5 children is the statistic that we use. And again, with statistics, they can kind of vary a little bit either way, but that's the CDC number that we use. And I mean, it's easy to say a number, but when you stop and think about a classroom of children, 1 in 5, it could be a quarter of the kids.
Yeah.
And that is so hard to think about, but I think it's the reality that we need to talk about.
So you started in social work. Let's mm-hmm. talk a little bit about what kinds of things you saw or that we're seeing now. What kind of behaviors are we seeing? What should we be looking for as far as, like, I mean, I'm a teacher, so mm-hmm. I was, you know, I'm one of those that's legally required to report. There are several other groups of professionals that are legally required to report. I hope everyone reports.
Mm. Yes.
any suspicions. You don't want to ruin somebody's life, but you certainly want to see what kinds of things are we looking for kids that have experienced this kind of trauma.
And so just to start with you talking about reporting, yes, some of us are mandatory reporters, teachers, social workers, coaches, things like that. But I think it's important to remember that we're all ethical yeah. reporters. And I always encourage people to err on the side of caution. These are kids' lives. And okay, so if you've, you know, made a mistake, it's not true, that's okay. I would rather always try to protect a child than not. Yeah. And then as for signs, there's physical signs, behavioral signs, emotional signs. And I think one of the hard things is when we're looking at children, I have two daughters who are in college, and I know how many developmental stages that they went through that I just shook my head and said, really? What is this now? And so sometimes we look at things and say, okay, this is acting out. This is a developmental stage. This is something's going on at school. But behavior really tells a story. We communicate through our behavior. And so changes in children's sleeping patterns, you know, being scared to shower, bathe, go with certain people, acting out, temper tantrums, crying a lot, withdrawal, things like that can be normal everyday things going on that you're like, oh yeah, that's another stage there.
I have a 15-year-old.
Yeah, you're like, yeah.
We go through a few of those.
But it also could be the sign of something different. So having mm-hmm. ongoing open communication is important. And then, of course, there's physical signs, the more typical physical signs that you would think of possibly associated with sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I guess then what happens to what's the process, I guess? So if you are feeling like you see something or something's a little off, what would be like next steps?
You can call the police or Child Protection Services.
Okay. So I think that's an important way for us to start thinking about it. Let's also maybe when we come right back, let's talk more about some of these preventative things that we want to get into. So we'll do that when we come right back.
A gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on KSLpodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are back here with Chris and Betsy from Sapria. And we're talking about child sex abuse, and it's a really difficult topic, but it needs to be talked about. I have a lot of people come to me, especially in the last year or so, and saying, we really need to work on, you know, this idea of sex trafficking and all these things. And I'm like, yes and yes. But, and I keep, in my gut, I keep thinking, what about making sure this doesn't happen to the 1 in 5 children in this state? How do we do that? That's, I guess, where my heart is. I'm always looking at upstream. How do we get upstream? I mean, you don't want to have to, if we could go through and not have therapy for people that have been sexually abused, we would think that was fabulous, right? Don't you?
Absolutely.
The goal. And so for me, and yes, we need to provide that because we know it's happening clearly. But how do we get upstream of this? I guess that's kind of the issue I would like to think about and tackle. So, Chris, talk to us a little bit about this idea of getting upstream.
Oh, I love this. And I love that you asked. This is at the heart of what we do in our preventative work. And I'm going to share maybe a brief story that highlights a critical principle. But I also want your listeners to know that I'm going to barely scratch the surface to this question. And all our resources are free on our website. I would encourage people to spend time at sapria.org to further answer the question you've asked. But let me start with the story. My now 21-year-old daughter, when she was in sixth grade in Lehigh, Utah, just down the road from here, she came home and she said, "Dad, I heard this word on the playground, and I don't know what it means." She said, "I know it has something to do with sex, but I don't know what it means." I'm going to just pause there for a minute. Sixth grade girl talking to her dad, willing to ask this question, is the key to prevention. So she asked the question, "What does the word prostitute mean?" She had heard it on the playground. When we talk about getting upstream, this story highlights the most critical principle, and Betsy referenced it a little bit before the break, and that is open dialogue with our children is the number one preventative factor for child sexual abuse. And it starts at the youngest of ages when we're teaching them the basics about their body and boundaries and respecting the space of their siblings, all those things that teach critical principles of consent, as well as having open discussions as parents with our children around sexual health so that kids have the words to describe what they may be experiencing or seeing. Consider the alternative of my daughter. If she didn't feel comfortable asking dad or mom or some other trusted adult, where is she going to go for the answer? And it's Google, because she's going to get the answer.
Yep.
And if she goes to Google, she's opened up a door to predatory behavior that is going to put her in immediate harm's way. Most sexual abuse today is the actual physical side of sexual abuse is preceded by some sort of digital interaction. Okay. So that's a key part of being upstream. A couple other key upstream principles that we need to understand is that parents are the linchpin. There are so many other good preventative things going on. We need good policy. We need good things in our education systems, good after-school programs, one of your initiatives, great foster care, right? Empowered educators, another one of your show-up initiatives. We need all of those things to bolster the child. They're all part of the equation. But if mom and or dad or whoever is that primary caregiver in that child's life is missing, the other things almost become, I don't want to be callous and say irrelevant, but the ability for those other things to move the needle on this particular issue, it's really unlikely they will significantly reduce incident rates. So we need the combined effort of all that good work going on to support the family, but we've got to empower mom and dad to know the signs, know how to educate their children. And here's the best news about this. It doesn't take a significant amount of time or effort for mom or dad to learn how to prevent and to implement behaviors that are preventative. The only reason my daughter was willing to ask me, her dad, the question about sex and use the word prostitute is because there had been hundreds of little conversations before that.
Yeah.
And they're normal and natural in our household. They happen every day. They happen every week. They're comfortable. So when something that could put our children at risk comes up, they're willing to ask. And intervention is one of the most critical parts of prevention.
Yes. Let me give you a contrasting story of a sixth grader, myself. So I was in sixth grade, and I seriously think about this often. I was sitting in my classroom, and one of my friends in my class, who I knew just from school, it wasn't like I knew her outside of school. This middle school, now we have towns coming from, you know, all different. So it's somebody I had just met. And she started crying. And I said, you know, so me and my couple of other friends were saying, what's the matter? What's the matter? Are you okay? Through her sobbing, heaving tears. And at this point, I'm like, I have no idea where the teacher was. But through her sobbing, heaving tears, and with my little, there weren't a lot of conversations about sex going on in my family, a little bit, but not a ton. And through my, just what I knew and basically what she was telling me, she told me that her brother was sexually abusing her. And truthfully, the words she was using and the limited vocabulary I had, and her making us as friends promise not to tell, I never said a word.
Yeah,
I never told my parents. And to this day, I'm sick about it. That I didn't do something. I didn't say anything because I didn't know what to do. So, Betsy, let's talk a little bit about this, our brain, our biological reactions when faced with trauma. I mean, Chris, you talked about having those connections in our heads already. Let's talk a little bit about what happens to someone when the abuse is starting, or grooming starts to happen, or whatever it is. What is our biological reaction?
So there's three different responses to trauma, and you've probably heard that: fight, flight, or freeze. And so fight and flight are pretty obvious. But freeze is usually what happens to children, because if you think about it, it's not safe to fight someone who's larger than you, someone who is responsible for you, someone who maybe the provider in the home there's a power differential. So you can't fight or flight. And so kids freeze. And that freeze keeps people safe. Basically, our brains kind of shut down, take you to somewhere else. We use the term dissociate, where you're like, okay, something bad is happening to me, but I can go elsewhere. And that's usually what happens with children, because they don't have an option.
Mm. Yeah. And, you know, as they get older, I know the issue with consent is a problem with that freezing, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I was talking earlier about a book that I read, and it's called The Unthinkable. It's how we deal with disasters, and it's kind of talks about big disasters. But it also talks about the idea that if we have data points in our head, if we know what to do, our bodies won't freeze. You know, as say a teenager, if there's an incident where there's potential sexual assault, if we have, you know, it's like if there's a fire and you have prepared and you've walked through your fire route and you've walked through how to get out of the house and what to do, if you're able to have all those scenarios in your head, what don't you think that translates into being able to overcome sort of those initial fight, flight, or freeze?
So there's two parts of that I want to address. Yeah. I just want to call out where you say that freezing is not consent, because I want to make sure that everyone hears that.
Yes, thank you.
Because it's just like being drunk and passed out is not consent.
Exactly.
If you have a history of trauma responses, let's say it's the 16-year-old who's also had abuse earlier in his or her life, and they freeze, that's not consent. That's a trauma response.
Yes.
Consent is...
Thank you. That's exactly what I meant. Thank you for making my words make sense.
I never miss an opportunity to talk about that.
Yes.
I think the other thing that you spoke to, it really speaks to what Chris just said. This is educating our children about abuse. This is giving them the words and for what's happening and talking about boundaries and the ability to say no and my body belongs to me and all of these things that might head off some grooming things. Obviously, there are instances where it's not going to matter what that child says or does.
Yeah.
However, those little conversations with parents, like Chris was talking about, those are so – they're just key. Ongoing communication so people can say, hey, I'm not feeling quite right about this. This person is crossing some boundaries for me. And that's laying those, you know, neural pathways in your brain so that when something happens or it's getting closer – they know who to reach out to for help, talk about. And unfortunately, if something does happen, then they have the ability to say, hey, this bad thing happened to me, and you can get them help.
How do you – I've struggled with this as a parent. How do you teach a child all these things and as a parent learn all these things yourself without sort of – I mean, we talk about their innocence or you know – just how do we do that without them being fearful of adults in their lives?
Can I take that one, Betsy?
Of course you can.
So we have a saying, defending innocence is not defending ignorance. Our children need to be empowered with words. They need to be empowered with boundaries. And what we find, and I'll speak more from my experience as a parent than even from a professional side, because I've lived this and breathed this. Mm-hmm. We've talked to our kids about age-appropriate topics from the youngest of ages all the way till they leave our house. Not once have I seen either their behavior or their words say, I'm more fearful because you talked to me. Mm-hmm. I've seen the exact opposite. I've seen my daughter in high school stand up to a boy that kept hugging her when she said no several times and get firm and in his face till he backed off. Mm. That's empowering.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that boy would have sexually assaulted her or not. I'm not saying he would have.
But it kind of doesn't matter, right?
But like, it kind of doesn't matter. It was her space.
Yeah.
It was her boundary. And she held it. Mm. That's very empowering. And it actually builds courage and resilience in our kids and dispels fear. It's important that's age appropriate. I'm not talking to my 3-year-old about sexual assault yet. But I am talking to my 3-year-old about, hey, this is your body. This is what your body does. These are the names of, you know, your arm or leg or whatever. I'm teaching those things, and I'm teaching my 7-year-old, hey, when your sister says stop, it means stop. Mm. You know, and I'm teaching my 8 or 9-year-old about, hey, pornography's coming your way. How are you going to deal with it when you are exposed to it? Or, you know, this is how sexual intimacy works. Because I don't want someone else to be the first one to teach them about one of those principles as a parent. So I'll take my parenting hat off a little bit and put my professional hat back on and just say, this is easier than it sounds. The resources are available. Again, it's PREA.org, but there's also a lot of other good organizations in our own state that have excellent resources to help parents. And so, if you'll just spend a little bit of time, put this issue on your list. Start having that first awkward conversation. Awkward will turn into comfortable and fluid and normal and natural really fast.
Yeah. So, Betsy, what is there anything else that you would add to that?
One of the things that always strikes me is as parents, we get really frustrated as our children say no, right? Think of a 2-year-old and every answer is no. But that's something we want to empower in our children is an ability to have choices and to say no on things that are low stakes, things that you can still run your household with and everything. But teaching at an early age, you get to make some decisions and you get to say no. And I think that's so important.
That's interesting. And I'm thinking about, I think as I learned more about sort of these ideas of empowering children around their own bodies, I remember thinking about when, you know, you come, and it's very innocent and grandparents are wonderful, but it's, you know, come give grandma a hug before she you leave. And the kid's like, no, you go over and give grandma a hug. And I thought, you know, as I kind of went through my parenting, I thought, no, it's okay if they're okay with not. I mean, they can certainly say thank you, grandma, for letting me come, or thank, you know, whatever it is. But they don't need to go give grandma a hug if they're not into it. So it's kind of a thought I've had.
You're right on. And you know, depending on the relationship, if the relationship's good, most of the time they want to give grandma a hug.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
But giving them the choice sends a clear message. You get to choose. You're in charge of your body. You're in charge of how you show affection and others show affection to you. And so it's an example that's often referred to that carries into so many other relationships. I just want to share one piece of good news back to this topic. And that is, there is a huge part of sexual abuse that we can prevent fairly easily. And that's older child on younger child. So all these principles we've been talking about are not only good for helping reduce the likelihood your child will be abused, but also reduce the likelihood that your child will abuse somebody. Because a 14-year-old that's abusing a 9-year-old is a completely different issue than a pedophile. And we kind of lump them together, and they're not. And nearly half of child sexual abuse is an older child, usually a teenager, abusing a younger child. We can knock out half of child sexual abuse just by parents engaging.
Mm. Wow, that's really powerful. I want to keep talking about this and how you talked a little bit, you alluded to it, but the stuff we're working on at Show Up, how this plays in, and we'll do that when we come right back. We are back here on First Lady and Friends. We're talking with Betsy and Chris about our shared passion for preventing child abuse, specifically sexual child abuse. And we want to get into the fact that we intersect in so many ways, and the stuff that we're working on that I didn't even sort of realize that we were intersecting. But this issue, of course, it just sort of permeates our society. And Chris off mic was saying about car seats. I love that analogy. Talk a little bit about that.
So I was born in 1974. My first child was born in 1998. When I grew up, I don't even know that a car seat existed in Orem. There was probably one or two.
I've never seen one when I was little.
Right?
We're close to the same age.
By the time I was a parent, not only myself, but all my peers had their children in car seats. We went through a societal transformation in one generation of parents because of awareness, education, and a lot of money thrown at that problem. And we're starting that same transformation with sexual abuse. The fact that we're even talking about it and sharing this with your listeners, that's that awareness piece. Yep. The Sapria.org, where the education is, that's the education piece. And as funding continues to grow, we're going to see a similar type of transformation with this societal issue.
I hope so. I really do. And I think you're absolutely right, because we have to.
Yeah.
We have to. This cannot continue. People have to be able to go through their lives without this type of trauma. We have so much other trauma we'll work on after that, but this is really important. But so our Show Up initiative, we have 4 focus areas, and we've been working really hard on them. And we want to talk about how this intersects. So the first one is educator wellness. We've been talking really hard. A lot about how we get this message to teachers that they matter, that what they're doing is important, and that their wellness is key to being able to teach children how to be well. So let's talk about how, Betsy, how that interacts with what you guys are doing.
Absolutely. So we have amazing teachers in Utah.
I agree.
Yes. And I have also been an educator, and I think sometimes people think of this myth of like, oh, the teacher just sits and teaches English or chemistry or math and that's it. That's not it at all. Teachers are involved with the holistic well-being of a child. And one of those ways that teachers, I think, can feel really empowered is to be educated about signs of child sexual abuse and prevention, because teachers deeply care about their students and they want to keep them safe. And in the younger grades, kids are there all day. So this is an area where, and I'm not saying, I know teachers are so busy.
Yes.
And there's so much, but just having an awareness of what these issues are. So the child information, I want to say this right, Child Welfare Information Gateway, which is childwelfare.gov. Sapria is listed on there under their school-based prevention page. We're actually the first resource.
Fantastic.
I mean, we're the first, but all the rest are really good too. They're all amazing resources.
Yes. We'll put that out there.
I encourage teachers to go to that website or to our website, sapria.org, and just take 5 minutes. Look at what those signs are. Look at things you can do for prevention and educate yourself, because kids who are being hurt, who are experiencing trauma, have a very difficult time learning because they're consumed with staying safe, not with learning their times tables. So we need to catch this, support them, get them the help they need, and teachers can really play a role in that.
Yeah, and what we're learning with the things we're talking about with this, you know, emotional self-reliance and emotional intelligence mm-hmm. skills is that when those needs are addressed, the academic performance actually significantly increases, and the behavior, the negative behaviors and the things that the kids are exhibiting that prevent them from connecting with their teacher and or connecting with other students in the class really are decreased when these issues are addressed properly. And so I just think that's critically important. We're also working in foster care, again, with the child welfare area. Kids in foster care, first of all, are usually, they have already been abused in some way, shape, or form. And you can probably, Chris, tell us a little bit more about the statistics of that. But what can we do as far as our foster children? How can we connect in this area?
Yeah, there needs to be a little more research to really hone in on the statistics and make them firm. But we do know for sure that incident rates are significantly higher for children that are in foster care. And for foster parents, it's not unlike the teacher piece. A big part of their well-being and emotional resilience is giving them the tools and the resources that they need to care for those that they love, including these foster children. They become that primary caregiver.
Yeah.
They become that parent for that child and fill that role. And, you know, foster parents amaze me, the sacrifice, the willingness. And if they'll spend a little time educating themselves about sexual abuse on both sides, both the prevention and the healing side, because it's likely they will have to deal with both, it will empower them and help them with their own well-being, not unlike the conversation we were having about the teachers.
Yeah, no, that is exactly right. And really, statistically, kids in foster care are significantly increased rate of suicide, increased rate of incarceration, of, you know, all these social troubles because of the trauma that they've faced. So I love that idea of really supporting foster parents and families to do that work of healing and prevention. It's so cool.
I'll share just a couple of stats to reinforce what you just said. So an individual that's been sexually abused is 3 times more likely to attempt a suicide, not to be suicidal or have suicidal ideation, to actually attempt. 85% have a diagnosed mental health disorder by age 30. So foster families are dealing with the acute impact of this early childhood trauma that leads to these life outcomes that we fight every day to reduce. Yeah. including substance abuse, eating disorders. I could share stats on each of these. And and yes, they're corollary stats, but when you get that many corollary stats, it's not a coincidence. Early childhood trauma, whether it's sexual abuse that we're talking about today or physical abuse or neglect, is really at the root of many of our societal social ills that we're trying to fight every day.
That's exactly right. Another of our areas is service. And you're participating in this area of foster care.
Yeah.
And service.
And service. So as it relates to service, and I love that this is one of your initiatives to get people involved in service. We're a community of service-oriented people. That's no secret. The state of Utah loves to serve. Well, when it comes to service opportunities, we can be a source of service opportunities, whether it's for groups or individuals. If you want to help adult female survivors of childhood sexual abuse, we have service projects that can be done from home. They can be done at a workplace. They can be done at our office. And you get to calm. I'll just describe one of them. Preparing blankets for the women that come through our 4-day in-person retreat program. It's one of the very first things they get, because as they come to deal with their childhood sexual abuse from 20 years ago, 30 years ago, they are nervous. The anxiety is filling their body. They've probably not talked about it. And if they have, they haven't talked about it very much. And here they are about to open this wound.
Yeah.
And those blankets get wrapped around them, and they don't leave those blankets the whole time they're there. And I see them when we see them afterwards, they still have them. You know, it's a little bit of the Linus effect, not from the childhood standpoint, but providing those critical comforts, that compassion. So that's just one example, helping to prepare those blankets, of how people can serve survivors of child
sexual abuse. And Utahns love to make blankets and quilts. So, so it's the perfect,
right in,
it's the perfect service that we can do. And then just finally, let's talk about Special Olympics. And I know people are thinking, how does that tie into child abuse and child sex abuse? But Betsy, your PhD in special education. And just, I want to talk a little bit about the rate of abuse among our kids with disabilities.
I will try not to talk on and on for the next 8 hours, because I know that this podcast is not that long. But this is an incredibly important topic and really near and dear to my heart for the reasons you said. Children with disabilities are, at a minimum, 3 times more likely to be sexually abused. The research is hard to get due to a variety of factors, but the research ranges anywhere between 3 times more likely to be sexually abused up to like 6.5 times more likely. Children with multiple disabilities are at higher risk, so think a physical disability with a communication disorder or something like that. And I think there's a lot of myths around children with disabilities and sexual abuse, things like, well, who would abuse a child with a disability? And I know we all like to think no one would, but unfortunately, that's not accurate. Yeah. Another myth is, well, because of the disability, they don't really experience trauma. And in fact, when we look at the research, it shows children with disabilities actually may have a tougher time, for a variety of reasons, kind of processing that trauma and working through it.
Yeah.
And so the same things apply to children with disabilities as they do with typically developing children. So you want to talk about those boundaries. You want to teach body ownership. A very big one is that saying no, because sometimes with kids with disabilities, we're teaching compliance so much. So saying, yeah, it's okay for you to say no. You get these choices. Teaching healthy sexuality is important. And it's interesting, because often we think, well, we would do that at whatever cognitive level a child is with. But that's not actually – that's not true. It has to be based on what biological age they are, and then you shift the content and how you're approaching it. But their bodies are going to mature, so you still need to be having those sexuality – healthy sexuality conversations. And I think – I just really encourage parents and teachers and people interacting with these kiddos, give them the words to say they're being hurt for their body parts. I've read interviews with people as adults who are adults with disabilities saying, I was being hurt and no one ever gave me the words to say what was happening. And that just gets me in the heart.
Yeah. Yeah. And even if it's not actual verbal words, if it's a sign, a sign language, we teach our kids that are nonverbal a lot of sign language because they're sometimes very receptive to language. Mm-hmm. They're just not expressive. And if you give people signs, that's one way to help kids be able to still feel empowered and be able to communicate what's happening. So I love that.
And definitely watch the behavior also, because as I said before, behavior speaks volumes. And sometimes, just like they're typically developing peers, we think, oh, this must be a thing related to disability, when in fact they're trying to tell us something.
Yeah. And be an ally, I guess, with our unified sports, with the Special Olympics. There are just such emotional stories. One I just heard last night from a teacher who said this has absolutely changed the culture in their school, that kids are developing friendships so that they have peers as allies for them. And she had a student who was a peer on the basketball team with a student with disabilities, and she went around to every one of this child's classes and said, please help her. If she needs help, this is what you need to do, and this is how you do it. And I mean, it's beautiful, it's wonderful, and it takes all of us working together to protect our children, to make sure that every child has a sense of love and belonging in the most healthy ways possible. So I appreciate all you guys are doing. Thank you so much, Chris, Betsy. You guys have been amazing. You're amazing partners with Show Up, and we really appreciate that, and we appreciate your expertise. And we'll leave the information on our outros to make sure that everybody can contact you and get those education tools that we need. So thank you.
Thank you for having us. It's been so delightful.
Yes, thank you so much.
You can find Sapria at sapria.org for more information on how to prevent and education around child sex abuse, as well as childwelfare.gov. Thanks for being a friend.